Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Doctor, look.
Stand aside, nurse. I'm Dr. Homebrew.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Dr. Homebrew. I'm excited for today's show because we have longtime friend Barry from Lucky Envelope Brewing up in Seattle, Washington, as Tasty used to say. Barry, welcome, dude. Welcome to the show. This is your first time being on our show. You've been on the session a couple times, I think, right?
Just once on the session. Super stoked to be on Dr. Homebrew.
Yeah, man, Barry's a good dude. If you guys, you know, I've always said if you're in Seattle, go over to Ruben's Brews first. And get a couple good beers, and then go, you know, if you have time, just drive by Lucky Envelope and just wave. You don't have to go in waving, just run, pop in, tell Barry we said hi, and then leave, and then go back to Ruben's Bruce. That's what I always said.
Leave the car running. Yeah.
Now, Barry's making some very, very good beer over the past few years, and he's gracious enough to send me some, and so I'm like, you know what, we need to get Barry on the show, because Barry, number one, listens to the show, which is very weird and distressing for most people probably in his life, but I wanted to see what knowledge he can impart on us, and he said, well, here, I actually have beers for you to take and to drink and to give me feedback on, and specifically, this is a collab beer you did, Barry, right? With a couple of friends of the show. Who's this beer with?
This is a beer that we brewed with Dave Marlioff from New Spring. Oh, I should correct it and say New Springs because, he hates it when I call it New Springs. And
well, that's all I'm going to do from now on then. Thank you for giving me that.
Yeah. Yes. And Warren Billups.
There we go. Beardy.
Oh, yeah. Warren. At Angora. So that's his brewery distillery that's in progress.
I didn't even know it had a name.
Yeah. So that's the one on the side of the can. And that was the fun one that we wanted, that I thought would be a pretty cool discussion, because everybody talks about competitions being, you know, just as much a packaging competition as a beer competition. And we had it in the tank. And we just canned it off on, you know, right around the time that JP sent me the email. So I figured I could bottle some the way that we send beers off to competitions, and then I can also just give a can to sample.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. So it's, we have a, it's side a great by idea. Side.
That's really geeky. I like it.
Oh yeah, totally. I'm trying to get these data points, and then so I'm glad that everybody volunteered to be test specimens.
I got to say, Barry, I don't know, maybe it's the 480p camera you have, but you look younger, man. You look good. It's good to see you.
It's already like 30 minutes past my bedtime.
It's a filter. What's going on?
It's the smoothing filter.
I need to go get a second glass if we're going to do side by side.
Yeah, Barry's right 26. Now. He's been brewing since he was 12. Yep. And, you know, he just knows everything about it. Yeah, I'm excited about it, man. I think this would be cool. And this is called Swiss Army Beer, and it's an Alpine Red Lager.
Yeah.
What's an Alpine Red Lager?
I don't know. No. Okay. I was just discussing it with Brian Cooper, and this is a fun beer. Okay. That's a fun beer that we came up with a recipe, and then we were trying to figure out some fun ways to make it interesting for people. And the recipe we decided on was, it was like a red lager that we brewed with a lager yeast from the Hurlemann Brewery in Switzerland. So, so with that, we're just trying to think of some interesting names. And that's where the Alpine Red Lager came into play, just because of the Swiss Alps. And that's kind of where that whole thing came from. And then the logo design is very reminiscent of, you know, the Swiss flag and all that. So it was just it was an excuse for the three of us to finally brew together, because we've been talking about it for, you know, 5-6 years. Yeah. And it finally came together, and Dave had some free time because he was preoccupied with some things for some reason. I don't know why. And,
yeah, it's a big fat lawsuit. And now he's half a millionaire, you know?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
If he ever gets it paid out.
And then Warren was able to get some time out with his kid and being able to balance that life out. So it just came together and we wanted to brew a beer and we were just looking for any excuse. And the Swiss Army beer, Alpine Red Lager, was what happened.
Was born. Yeah, well, I snuck a quick sip. It's very good. It's very toasty. Yeah. And I've always loved red ales, man. I wish they would make a comeback. And I think part of the problem is nobody knew really how to brew them. So you get a lot of red ales that are just super caramely.
Yep.
A lot of crystal malts, and it just sort of fucking killed it. It was just bad. But you get a nice, decently brewed red lager or red ale in general. Mm-hmm. So good. I love it.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, so we have a hand bottled version and we have the canned version.
Yep. I'm going to step out and get my bottle opener because I forgot to bring it over.
Oh my
and,
God.
And per our communications yesterday, I did a score sheet for the bottled one with noting some differences between what I may have perceived between the canned version. And I think Cooper may have done a score sheet also, or at least to have some notes about that.
Cool. Well, Char, why don't you start off then?
Begin, all right.
Basically, just to clarify, Bear, you want to know a bunch of stuff, but mainly if there's a difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, right. So what I did, Barry, is I did a score sheet for the bottled version and noted any differences that I could tell between that and the canned version that were perceptible. So I went through in category 34C. This is sort of a brand new specialty, experimental beer, which I appreciate. The bottle inspection, bottle was great size. Fill level was good. There was a hiss when I opened it up, so the bottling went well. Aroma, it's got a medium to medium high malty aroma. It has to me a medium leathery note in a good way, in a way that a really good Syrah has kind of a leathery character to it. It's not like a brand new out of the store, oh, it smells funky type of thing, but more like you think of a comfortable leather chair that you've set on for a while, not like the aroma that I might get from you, but the fact that it kind of gets softer and more, more comfortable. There is sort of an aroma to that. That when I learned about wine, I was told that's sort of a leathery character. Some red wines get. It's related to the toasty that JP was talking about. I don't know that I would call it roasty or toasty, but it's maybe in that family, if that makes sense. But it's a very unique aroma, which I really like. The bottled version to me maybe has slightly less aroma overall than the canned version. And by less, it's probably in the 10% range, which I thought was interesting. Probably because the can, once you seal it, that thing is hermetically sealed. Nothing's getting in or out. That may be the reason. I don't know. But there was I couldn't detect any difference in character of the aroma between the bottled and the canned one. So I give the aroma 9 out of 12. Appearance 3 out of 3. It's dark amber, light brown color. It might even be in the medium brown territory. But it's the color is what I would think of for a red lager. Orange highlights, crystal clear. The head is low and persistent. And frankly, I thought that the head was similar, but right when I poured them both, and I poured them both at the same time, the bottled sample had a little more persistence and a little more head than the canned one.
Yeah,
which
same
was
thing. That's what you can see which one's the bottled one. And
that's interesting. And I have no idea, from a scientific or engineering standpoint, why that would happen. I just find that fascinating. So
agreed.
Coop may have some better perspective on that than I do, but flavor-wise, this beer tastes amazing. Flavor starts with a medium malt with that kind of toasty, leathery malt character that's just so, so wonderful. Bitterness comes up in mid-palate to balance, but bitterness is not super high, but it's it doesn't overwhelm the malt, but I think it's right there where it needs to be. It's well attenuated. The finish is long and balanced. The impression that I had when I poured these is the bottled one had a little bit more bitterness in the finish. And kind of coming back to this, let's see what I think. Well, nothing like live guy drinking beer live on air.
Great audio.
But it really is.
Hey, man, they've been doing it that way for 10 fucking years. I can't get them to stop. So at this point, you just embrace it.
Yes, I will embrace the drinking beer. Just four guys drinking beer on air.
Yeah, man, who cares?
No, and as they warm up some, I think that the difference in bitterness is not really there. It wasn't a giant difference. It was in 10-15% in the finish, maybe. But as they warm up, I'm not really tasting much of a difference with that. Flavors, again, at 16 out of 20. Mouthfeel, 5 out of 5. Body's medium. Carbonation's medium. There's a slight warming that may have come from the fact this is the third sample that I had in judging tonight. So sometimes that happens. It's neither creamy nor astringent, but it's perky.
This card tastes great. 5 out of 12.
I'm going to eat some more of this paper. The bottled version has maybe a little bit more body in my perception, and maybe slightly smaller bubbles. But again, we're talking, these are very minor differences. But I did find that interesting, that to me, and that's it's consistent even as it warms in my perception. The bottle one has slightly more body, 5 out of 5. Overall impression, 9 out of 10, for a total of 42. I really like this beer a lot. It's creative and new and really different. And I appreciate you guys sharing this beer. I really like it. I don't really know how you'd make this better. I mean, you might want to mash with some of Warren's beard hair, kind of like Tasty and the dog hair. But I don't know, the FDA or TTB or somebody might not be terribly keen on beard hair and the mash. But there are some subtle differences between the canned sample that I poured from the can, the sample that I poured from the bottle. But I don't think they were extensive. And the biggest one, like you were showing the camera a minute ago, was the head. Mm-hmm. The head is probably the biggest difference. And frankly, from the standpoint of sending that to GABF, you're probably always better off with more head than less head. So to the extent there's a difference, it's probably working in your favor.
Mm-hmm. Which was which, Barry, in those glasses? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. The one on the right side of the screen is this one. This one is the one poured from a bottle.
Interesting.
And then this one's poured from the can. So
wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's something in the can liner that might be affecting the head retention, but
I have heard that theory before.
Interesting.
Because this beer has plenty of crystal malt, like not plenty, but has a decent amount of crystalline malt in there, whatever, a couple percent, which definitely helps that head retention go. But that's one of the things I've always noticed from the cans is that the head, like it fades pretty quick. But
interesting.
Yeah. One of the notes I was curious about, especially with this red lager, is did you pick up on any I haven't let Brian Cooper speak, so I can I can just shut up right now because
I'm just going to comment generally. I agree with a lot of what Brian said, and I think that as far as amber lagers go, there's in the style guidelines, there's international amber lager and there's Czech amber lager. I would say this plays a lot more like the Czech version, which to me is more characterful and a richer beer, as opposed to the light or the amber, international amber lager, which can be adjunct laid and mass produced beer. I mean, the Czech ones are, pretty big. They don't get distributed as far as some of the amber lagers, but Dos Equis or whatever. But this is a really enjoyable beer, and I like the way it's playing. It's not too sweet. It's nice and dry, but it also has some some caramelly and I would say maybe some dark Munich-y or not even edging on roast, but like a nice richness to it that makes it a real nice sipper. In this time of year, in the colder months, to sip something that has a little body and heft to it, but it's not 10% alcohol. between the two samples, they both taste and smell really, really similar. The head difference is noted. I think that the bottled version might be just slightly more carbonated because it is a little spritzier and it's a little more not biting, but it has a little slightly sharper presentation. Whereas the canned version, it comes across just a touch sweeter, but it's just a minor difference in either the carbonation or the way that the head is being retained. But the two taste really, really similar. There's no oxidation, nothing odd in either of these.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
But
to hear.
I like the dryness.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And the flavor, the malt flavors come through nicely. But there's also a nice hop flavor here too. It's got like a floral and little spicy hop presentation. just really works well. I would agree with the score that Brian gave it. So, I don't have too much more to add. What do you think, JP?
You think of 42?
Yeah, 42, 43.
Okay. Good. All right.
Really good.
Well, I will take that. That's kind of awesome.
What do I think? You guys both sort of commented that the canned version is a little more carbonated. No, the bottle version is a little more carbonated than the canned version.
Yeah.
I find the opposite.
Yeah.
So maybe that's due to just a little bit of tiny bit of bottle variation. The bottled version seems a little smoother to me.
I was just trying to split hairs. It's really hard to, tell much difference.
That's what he wants. That's what we're here for, right? So I don't mind that. I don't fault you for being you, and being what your mouth is trained to. I don't know, whatever. Now the beer's kicking in. So now I'm being inappropriate.
Now it's just getting weird in here.
Yeah, the canned version to me is a little bit more. I think Cooper, you called it in the last show the attack. The attack is a little bit more, forceful. There's a little more bitterness to it. There's a little more oomph to it. There's a little pop. But I think I prefer the bottle version. It is a little smoother. There's no oxidation. I couldn't tell you the difference between the two. I don't detect a flaw. So whatever Barry's mass amount of assistants have been doing to do this while he's been on his yacht and on vacation, they've been doing a good job.
Yeah.
Because I don't detect anything weird or funky, but there is a slight variation comparatively, and I think I like the bottle version a little bit. It's a little more rounder. I think the canned version, maybe the bitterness just comes off a little bit more than the bottled. But excuse me. Barry, talk to us a little bit about this beer. Are we answering your questions, first of all?
Yeah, no, all this right. is good to hear, because what I was going to allude to earlier was there was talk about the the red ales, and there's not a lot of really great examples that you can get from around the country just because of age that shows up so easily in these beers. And, as a brewery that packages our beer, like oxidation, DO is, what I'm trying to avoid at all costs. And, when we're packaging our beers, the cans go, they're all open atmosphere canning. So they do have a couple seconds where they are exposed to the air. I mean, obviously you have a foam cap on it before the lid goes on, things like that. So, we do definitely get some pickup there, but when we bottle it, I bottled it the exact same way I do it for competitions, using a beer gun and going through all sorts of hoops to make sure that we're trying to reduce as much oxygen in the package, as far as even going as far as I'll dip the bottles in sanitizer, rinse it out, but I will rinse it with some beer, because in that sanitizer you still have 8 ppm of oxygen in those couple drops, which can add up. So I was just trying to see if there might be a difference in the perception. But with those red ales, red beers in general, I think those, when they get oxidized, that caramelly sweetness can get overboard, and it can even get kind of that metallic-y penny character, which is just not pleasant. But when they're done well, or when you can get them fresh, I really enjoy them. And that's like kind of the things that I'm always going through in my head, and where am I splitting hairs that are worthwhile, and where are we doing things that just might be excessive that you don't get much benefit out of. But I'm glad to hear that, because it's probably spent a day and a half kind of ambient temperature, probably in the 50s, and when we send our beers off to competition, especially for GABF, they sit in those coolers, which my understanding is that they're not like sitting there at 35, 40 degrees. They're sitting at 50-ish degrees, which for several weeks, and that's I think that's where a lot of the damage is done. But then in those competitions, and where I see them, the oxidation doesn't necessarily come off as it doesn't come off as papery. Or you might not even get that change in color, but you'll just get that amplified sweetness in there, and the beers can taste kind of flabby. So that's, in my head, that's kind of where I'm going. If any characters of the muddiness came through, especially in the canned beer, that's kind of where I was expecting it to come from. Mm. But if they're, if they're presenting pretty similar, that's very encouraging to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in that regard it is. But I wonder if would oxidation or oxygen presence, because I don't even want to call it oxidation, I guess, at this point, because it's not a flaw. But would that account for at least what I'm perceiving the difference between the canned and the bottle in the hop flavor For me, the can is a little bit more bitter, a little more aggressive than the bottle. Is that reason because maybe some oxygen got in the bottle and, you know, kind of, you know, did its magic and just happened to work out? Or what do you think?
Is that directed to me or is that directed
to I don't know, man. Anybody. Who cares? Whoever wants to talk.
I would kind of lean to it actually, like, if you get that oxidation, it kind of muddies it up. So you might not be able to taste it as much. I mean, I see that in as much in IPAs. I mean, that's amplified significantly. But yeah, when you get the ones that are slightly oxidized, you just get a little bit of that. Like, it almost, like, even if the IPA doesn't have any crystal malt in it, you can kind of, it almost tastes like there's crystal, but then that hop character just gets muddied and it's not as intense.
You know, I think that that makes sense to me, because one of the ways that oxidation can come through is sort of a honey character. And that tends to be extreme oxidation. That's not something that you're hopefully going to see, you know, between your brewery and the time someone buys that and takes it home. But there's an inner, right, there's a spectrum from no oxidation to, you know, you're eating a six pack carrier of cardboard, or from no oxidation to you're drinking a thing of honey. There's a spectrum in there, and sweetness is in that spectrum, right? I mean, honey has kind of a sweet perception. And if you're going to be, let's say it sits out someplace warm for a year and you're going to drink it, and it's going to be, you know, cloying honey, just nasty. That stuff has to, that doesn't all come at the end of a year. That takes place, you know, a day at a time while it's sitting somewhere warm. So you break that down to, okay, it'll be half that honey-like, or a quarter or a tenth, and somewhere you're in the start of that process, and it's going to be sweet rather than just that honey, that clear honey oxidation character. Does that make sense at all? Mm-hmm. So I think you're on the right track with that. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I don't get, to the extent I get any sweetness off of either of these beers, it's not sweetness that I would consider, you know, either oxidation or under attenuation. It's just malt sweetness.
Well, I think too, oxidation of the melanoidins, the Maillard byproducts in a darker, you know, a richer, maltier beer can express as a sherry-like character. It's not going to go straight to sherry, but a little bit of a sherry-like aspect in the beer that might be what's giving it that slightly sweeter honey-like impression, or a little off. And then it twists, you know, I know what you're talking about exactly. When you talk about that, the penny-like, it's not like a metallic necessarily, but it's like a biting, like the malt goes from being just pleasant and smooth and rounded to just being like harsh and gritty and biting and just a little gnarly. So yeah, I don't know. It can go a lot of different directions, but I'm not getting any negative oxidation in either of these samples. It's just clean beer.
It's cool. Yeah. I mean, the recipe was actually one of the more complex beers that we did. And
can we get that?
Yeah. I mean, it was about 30% Pilsner malt, and we actually split it between Barca, Weyermann Barca Pilsner, and Weyermann regular Pilsner. And then about 10%, these aren't going to add up to 100 because I don't have the actual percentages in front of me, but about 10% Munich 1, actually 20% Munich 1, Weyermann Munich 1, another 30% Weyermann Vienna malt, about 2.5% Weyermann Cara Red. So that's the crystal malt that we have in there. It's about, it's like, what, a 35 Lovibond crystal?
Mm-hmm. German crystal.
Yep, German crystal. Mm-hmm. And then 16 pounds, so about 1%, maybe just over 1% of Weyermann Carafa Special 2, which is the dehusked roasted malt.
I wonder if there might be a little, like, just to give the color, get that dehusked.
So we threw that in. It's more than we usually throw in, but then also Warren had a fun idea of making us do extra work, and, you know, we pre-ground it and then we threw it in on top of the mash, late mash Vorloff.
Right. You don't want to add it the whole way through the mash, but just at the end, just to get that color and it pulls through.
Just to get the color. And then
I like that approach.
Yeah. And then a 1.5% acidulated Weyermann sour malt, just to get that pH down to that 5.3 level.
I feel like I could tell Warren in that. Like, when you were reading out the malts and you said Vienna, I was like, that sounds like something Warren would contribute. I don't know why.
He makes a good lager.
He does, yeah, but I'm like, I don't know. Just, it seems like, oh, that, I don't know. You know, sometimes you can kind of tell people who make shit and you're like, oh, this sounds exactly like something that this guy would do. Like, Vienna malt sounds exactly like something Warren would be like, well, I really think we should do that.
Yeah. He was fighting for a little less Carafa, and then Dave was fighting for more. So I just we split the difference, and then I think Warren was going for more crystal, and then Warren wanted no crystal. So I split a bag in half. So there's some compromise going in there.
That's the way collabs then, go, man.
Yeah.
And did Warren and Dave like start pushing each other and like, no, you and have like a little slap fight or anything?
I
mean, or?
I would love that.
Anything to happen, anything to make, you know, incidental contact, cool. So no, it was a great time. We, we just hung out and it was fun, but
that sounds like a great time.
And the band is still together. Like when you guys get together and drink this beer together, you all enjoy it, I hope. Because
we haven't had that opportunity yet.
Oh,
but,
man.
I would like to. I know that. Yeah. But it was really cool when we did the packaging because Warren and his dad came out and they were helping to stack flats and all that. So that was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What what yeast did you use? Oh, you already said. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeast. We did. We used Fermentis S189.
OK.
So that's the Herleman yeast that they use there. And for us, we do 15 barrel batches. So it comes in 500 gram bricks. So we did three bricks that we rehydrated and threw in. So and then
you do rehydrate. Okay. Yep. I know some people don't, and there's a I don't know if there's a debate anymore, I guess, but just kind of like whatever you want to do.
For most of our beers, we don't rehydrate for like our ales, IPAs, and anything that's a little warmer. But I feel like for lagers, we get better performance from the yeast if we do we fill a keg with a brink with water from our hot liquor tank, and then we cool it down, and then we'll rehydrate in there and then just push it in the tank after or in the middle of knockout. But I don't think it's necessary, but for us, I think I found I personally feel like I get better performance for lagers, things that are fermented a little colder, things that undergo a little bit more stress. So like even if we
okay.
And there's chances that we have to do like a barley wine or like a high alcohol beer, and we don't have fresh yeast available, I will rehydrate that yeast too.
Got to baby it a little bit for those journeys that they're going to go through.
Yep.
okay. That makes sense.
And then, and then for like a 15, like the hops are pretty minimal, but for a 15 barrel batch, I mean, we did a first wort hop of a pound of Saphir and a pound of Hallertau Middle Fru. We just do that. We just did that for shits and giggles. 2.5 pounds of Magnum, which, that all equates to about 25 IBUs total. Mm-hmm. And that's probably closer to 20 IBUs. And then we did, in 5 minutes at the, before a 5 minute boil, 2 pounds of Saphir and 2 pounds of Middle Fru. So we kind of did treat it like a German Pilsner in terms of the hopping schedule. And, didn't go too crazy.
Balance. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's almost like Vienna Lager-esque.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a light Vienna Lager. Yeah.
It's in, I would agree that it's in that family. It's in that range.
Like it's definitely, 40% or something like that. Like you can kind of taste it. Oh yeah, I guess,
Yeah. It's another amberish lager. That's true.
Why I like it so much.
Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah. It's a cool beer, man.
Rich, rich maltiness and, really good balance altogether.
I was curious too, because I know that, especially as it warms up, but are you picking up any fruity esters or anything that might come from the yeast? Like, you can get some of that pear, but like even that, like that red apple note, sometimes we get comments of those in our judging sheets, but I've never used S189 before. So,
when you say red apple, yes, but I don't know if it's because you implanted it into my brain.
I shouldn't have done that. That was bad.
Blind
tasting.
Yeah, that's not all I get. Because it's funny. Because like I'm pouring it, you go, "Yeah, do you get any esters? Like pear?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, I remember that." And you go, "A red apple?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, that's what it is. It's not pear." So I can't tell you.
No, it's not. It's not.
No,
not very estery at all. There's
no.
Yeah.
That was kind of my opinion of this yeast. Is it definitely ferments a good bit cleaner than 3470. When subjected to similar fermentation conditions.
Yeah.
I mean, we fermented the same way, 52 degrees for day one until we see some activity, then we'll bump up to 53 and then it'll do its thing. But
And red apple to me, I don't get any of that at all. And that to me also has an astringent component to it. When someone mentions that it's not just a flavor, that there's something that's maybe astringent might be the wrong word, but there's a slight bitterness or a slight astringency to a red apple. Like a sharpness. And that's definitely not present. And I'm not getting, you know, I like JP, when you mentioned that, I'm straining to taste the red apple, that red apple skin. But I tried not to talk myself into it. You could talk yourself into a lot of things when you hear it.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially in college. Yeah, yeah. You know, like if you said red apple and it's less red apple skin, but sometimes, you know, the flesh of a red apple, you can be kind of mealy.
Yeah.
That's like an aroma that I can sort of find. Or if I was going to go red apple, if I was going to agree, I would be like, yeah, but just the flesh of the apple itself. But, you know, I had you not said it, I would be like, no, not really.
God, I shouldn't have said anything. I'm so stupid.
You're so dumb. God.
Barry.
Hang up on it. Hey, uninstall the
it's
game.
It's your first
already.
Time at Dr. Homebrew when you're talking about red apple skin.
Oh, we just keep JP because he's the host and he does all the editing for us.
That's all I do, man.
It really has no palate. No. Can't account for taste.
No. Half the time I just have a taste wheel and I throw a dart at it. I go, fucking sulfur, bitch. I don't know. Yeah, this beer is really cool. It is, and like Char was saying, it is kind of creative and unique and different in the space. How are your customers reacting to it? How's the general public feel about it?
I think they're liking it so far. Nice. I mean,
it sounds like a dumb question, but like I'm always curious about like when something comes out that's not a fucking pastry stout or an IPA. I want to know how people feel about it, especially if something that they don't really know what it is, and you have to learn and search for what it like. Alpine Red Lager. People are gonna. I don't know what that is.
No.
But are people creative enough, or you know, I don't know, enough of an explorer in the beer to be like, yeah, let's try the new thing and let's see, and we enjoy it, and it's not like anything we've ever had before.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are, and we do release every year a Vienna Lager that's received kind of really well by
you do. It's
both
good.
our customers, but also like critically too. That's how. It's done well. So when they come in and they ask like what's an Alpine Red Lager, and we can say that it's pretty similar to our Vienna Lager, just kind of amped up a little bit. You know, there's a little more malt character, a little more crystal in there, and you know, we use a different yeast which comes from Switzerland, so therefore we call it an Alpine Red Lager, and that kind of answers their questions. And but
that's enough.
You know, if they need like a quick answer, or they don't really care too much about beers, we just say, yeah, it's a red lager. It's like it's a multi red lager, so it's drier and cleaner than a red ale, like than a red ale. And
I wouldn't discount people though, because they're consumers are getting a lot more discerning and you know, understanding of different lager styles, and totally. And you know, there's a thirst for it. There's, you know, for a good a well-crafted lager and something like this. Yeah, you can.
Yeah, well, when we first opened in 2015, our number one question is what's a Hell's Lager?
And does that was, it come that, from hell?
I know. Yes, no, it's just German for light. But yeah. Now Hell's is everywhere.
With the Satanic Church, and it's called Hell Lager.
Is that a segue? Because we have some of your Hell's.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we do.
I also have the Italian pills.
Yeah, we're going to drink the Italian pills in the next segment. And I feel like the Hell's is just for funsies, which again I appreciate. If we're done with this, we're gonna take a break. What do you guys think?
We're good. Great.
All right.
Good idea.
We're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna come back. We're gonna talk about judging. Barry has done all kinds of judging. We're gonna talk about some differences between commercial judging and homebrew judging. How we can sort of I don't want to say game the system, but this is how you can cheat to win. If you want 50 point beers, stay tuned to the next segment. So hang on, everyone. It's Dr. Homebrew. We'll be right back. What's up, homebrewers? Hey, let me ask you a question. You spend a lot of time making your beer taste the way you want it to, right? Some of you even send beers in to Dr. Homebrew for feedback. Well, the next logical step in your creativity is to craft some labels for those beers. And there's nobody better at creative labels than GrogTag. Their easy-to-use designs let you turn out some pretty amazing stuff like labels, bottle caps, coasters, even six-pack carriers with minimal effort on your part. They have a range of label sizes that fit any vessel you can think of. Bottles, cans, growlers, kegs. GrogTag has you covered. Head over to GrogTag.com today and check out their line of amazing, fully customizable templates and get your beer looking its best. GrogTags are water resistant, reusable, and will have your naked bottles looking great in no time. That's GrogTag.com, and be sure to use code BNARMY at checkout to save 10% on your order.
Now, back to the examination.
All right, thanks for sticking around, everybody. We are back here with Barry from Lucky Envelope Brewing in Seattle. If you are in the Seattle area, seek them out. Go to their brewery. Check it out. It's great beer, great space, good brewer. You know what I mean? But Barry, you have been judging beers for a while now, and you sort of do the homebrew circuit and the commercial beer circuit. And so I want to talk a little bit to you about the differences between the judging and how judgings are necessarily even just run. Between homebrewing and commercial, but more importantly, how we were talking about the break is how you can really stand out in a commercial setting. We know how to do it as a homebrewer, sort of. I mean, you kind of have an idea of how to do it. Like maybe you need to tweak it a little bit to be, if you're doing a lager, maybe it needs to be, you know, a little bit more bitter or, you know, whatever, right? But as a commercial brewer, from what I hear, mainly from Sully, is that it seems like the flights in commercial competitions are larger because the score sheets are a little bit different. So as a judge, how do you pace yourself? And then also as a brewer on the other side of that, how do you have confidence entering a competition going, I could be one of like 25. How do you stand out in something like that?
Yeah. I mean, you're totally correct. I mean, so like my background was I started out, I went through the BJCP training through with Mark Emily and Peter Twigg. They're master BJCP judges up in the Pacific Northwest. And I learned so much from them and went through the course that they held. And so that's kind of where my basis for judging was. And, you know, when you go through a BJCP competition, there's definitely an emphasis on like notes, writing, fill that space, get all those comments in there and make sure, like, you know, make sure you get what you taste, but you have your progression of what you go through, your appearance, your aroma, because that's the most fleeting, and then the flavor and all that stuff, and then also revisiting your beers. And you know, I think the biggest difference between the BJCP homebrew competitions and professional competitions, as professional competitions, it's you're not necessarily trying to you're describing what you're tasting. You're not trying to like give advice or like if you did this, then you might want to try this, or like, you know, if you're getting oxidation, you might want to try to reduce pickup. It's just kind of this is what I taste, this is what I'm getting, and then like your overall comments, and then whether it moved on or not, and like what you said, the competitions are like you might have 50, 100. If you go to GABF, you'll have 200-300 beers in a category.
No.
Your speed is definitely of the essence.
Is it like two judges per flight, and you're doing 100 beers, or that seems impossible?
No,
it's like torture.
No. They still subdivide it into rounds. But what I've noticed is, you know, in most BJCP competitions I've done, and it kind of grows a little bit when you get into NHC, but I think most rounds are limited to kind of like eight beers in a flight. And, you know, if you have IPAs and you have 50 beers in that category, you'll have a couple rounds and then you can whittle it down. Then you have the mini best of show and you move things on. But for like the professional competitions, it's not uncommon to have like up to 12 beers in a flight. And when you have that, I mean, there's a significantly higher amount of luck that's involved, and just there's a lot of variance that can happen. And you know, you'll see it at the competitions at all levels. But then there's sometimes you just have to, you know, if you start butting heads with a judge, not like in a bad way, but you just start disagreeing or whatever. A lot of times you can just have to find a happy medium. But you know, of course, you always think that you're right, but it just depends on like who's going to give and take. But
I would definitely be like, yeah, I don't know. What do you think? Yep, I get that too.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. I'm kind of a pushover with stuff like that.
I think what I've noticed, though, is like, at least for me, which is encouraging, is the I feel like the era of the table bully has kind of gone by the wayside. Yeah. And there is a lot more compromising going on.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
That's interesting you say the table bully, because I do, it sort of brings me back to a lot of early competitions in like the late 90s, early 2000s, that there seemed to be that one person who knew everything. And then everybody would make fun of that person behind their back because they were fucking annoying. And it's like,
exactly.
Okay, yeah, oh, here's this for all you got to judge with, dude. Sorry, that sucks for you. But I'm glad to see that people, I wonder why that is. Maybe people just kind of like chilled out a little bit. Like, it's not that serious, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're going through that many beers and, you know, if you have 7-8 beers on a table and, you know, you're going to pass 2 or 1, you know, if there's like somebody that's, you know, really likes a beer and another person that really doesn't like that beer, is that beer going to do well in the next round or not versus, mm-hmm. you know, another yeah. beer that you both kind of like and another one that one person really likes, another person likes a fair amount or whatever. You just have to look at that like, okay, we kind of, you know, find the common ground, work together, don't die on the hill for something, but listen to the other person. And if they might have a valid point, oh yeah, okay, this maybe does have a little diacetylene or whatever it might be. And some people have to know their blind spots and be sensitive to, okay, I don't have the greatest, you know, detection of diacetyl, but I can detect phenolics like crazy. So let's just go in knowing that and be reasonable and listen.
So sometimes it's less about what that specific thing that you're arguing about, be it, you know, red apple or whatever, right? It just came to me. I don't know why.
Right. And the score sheets you get back on a commercial competition are like much more brief.
Right.
Just, you know, words on the sheet, you're lucky, you know, right?
You're lucky, yeah. But it's less about that specific thing that you're arguing about and more about the overall sum of the parts. Where like you're saying, is this beer going to do well? Even let's say I get my way, is it still going to even do well? And you have to like think about that a little bit more too. I've never really thought about that. Mm-hmm. Never thought about it that way.
Yeah. And then there's definitely a lot more. I feel like there's a lot more referencing the style guidelines in terms of like very hard at some point, because when you're doing those competitions, especially in the later rounds, like there are minuscule differences between the beers. And at some point, like you got to differentiate your beers. And I know that that happened for me when we didn't enter GABF this past year for other reasons. But I was doing like a second or third round of Helles. And the style guideline themselves, like they said, like body, medium. And then you look at it and you realize, wait, if you look at international examples, especially the ones in Germany, the body of those beers are not medium. They are medium light, mm-hmm. maybe medium. But, you know, and that's where at one point I caught myself like falling on that, like, no, the beers and the Helles that you get in Germany, they'll be medium light. They're not going to be medium bodied. And, mm-hmm. but like, what are the style guidelines saying? You're like,
yeah.
Ah, shoot.
Yeah.
But then, of course, like there's, they always offer the opportunities for feedback. So I did send feedback there. And I don't know if I was the only one, but I had a conversation with Chuck Skypeck there. And he's like, yeah, that's true. And they ended up changing the body description, I think, medium light to medium in terms of character for that. So like the style guidelines aren't perfect, but you have to judge the style guidelines. But
that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, activism works, is what you're saying.
Yeah, just voice, like, you know, your opinions are valid, and but if you don't let people know what your opinions are, then it's just gonna go die by the wayside. So if you have something constructive to say, then give your feedback, and if they have any questions, they'll come back. It's pretty simple, and mm-hmm. little proactivity never hurt anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're deciding to enter a beer. When you're deciding to enter beer for competitions, are you brewing for the competition? Because I've heard some brewers talk about that on the session years ago, where it's like, oh, this is, we would normally make this pale ale, but we tweak it for competition because we know that it's just going to get lost somewhere. Do you do that? Or are you sort of like, what's on the board, what's in the tank is what's going to competition?
Yeah. We don't necessarily tailor our beers towards the competitions. I know people that do that. And I think that's absolutely a way that you need to work it. But for us, it's like a lot of the beers that we enter end up being lagers. So for the most part, like if you make a beer specifically for competition, like what are you going to do to a Helles? You're going to make it
make it better.
What are you going to do with your Vienna lager? But like, you know, we have done things like in the past where like we will like our Vienna lager, we kind of brew in anticipation of the fall. But we know that GABF competition entries are due in August. So we'll brew it in July and ship it out for August, but then that also coincides with our season. So that's kind of the way that we approach it. But I can absolutely see it, especially for hoppy beers. It also depends on a lot of the breweries that do that. They might have additional capacity, or they're just like, if they're specifically brewing for it, they might just make a special IPA with like more hops or more hop product, or
do it on a pilot system versus their main
Yeah. And those are very valid ways to do it. I don't fault anybody for doing that way because it's a commercially sold product. You have the same right to brew a one barrel batch as somebody who has a one barrel batch. That's their main system or anything like that.
Yeah. With IPAs, they might time it to the day. Like, we're going to brew it on this day. So it's going to be ideal.
Yep. But then also there's, especially with IPAs, because those beers can sit on the, in the warehouse for, 2-3 weeks. So I know some people who had, people that have had success too, in the Seattle area, where they will package their beers, very green. And you're just like, well, mm-hmm. fingers crossed, it falls out and all that. But you see some of the folks that are winning, and if that's a strategy they take, it seems to work very well. So I know, especially with the hoppy beers, the earlier you can package it, the better, in terms of trying to preserve that hop character. But then you also see that double-edged sword of, well, if it's not fully done, then you can get those diacetyl bombs in there. And I was fortunate when judging a GABF, I don't think we had too many. I think it might have been two or three in a flight of 12 that had a little bit of diacetyl in there. But I've heard instances where especially before all the hop creep talk.
They dry hopped it in the can. Let's add one pellet of hops to each can. Get that extra. Yep. Oh, but you got hop creep. Sorry.
But, yeah. So, but then a lot of times you definitely could pull diacetyl from that. But I think people have changed their processes on a professional level to kind of avoid that diacetyl. But, when you're in those competitions, first round, I feel like that's pretty easy to, to quote a great man, the cream rises to the top. But you'll notice most of the flaws get knocked out in the first round. So,
yeah.
So diacetyl, DMS, but I think the biggest flavor that I noticed that would knock beers out was oxidation. So I think it definitely harkens back to my comment. There's the adage where beer competitions are just as much packaging competitions as they are brewing competitions. And going back to homebrew competitions, I feel like so many of them are local, and you're dropping it off at a homebrew store who will keep it cold. And then, and they'll ship it immediately to the brewery where they host it, and they keep it in the cold room. So they're kept pretty well. But then, once you get to that regional and national level of NHC, but a lot of the professional competitions, you're shipping your beers off to a couple states away. You're shipping it to Denver. That's a lot of damage can be done there. So a lot of that gets amplified through the shipping process, and then you don't even account for the process of folding. So those flavors of oxidation that you'll get some of the ones that just come out a little more honey, a little more sweetness, but then you'll definitely get more oxidated, just that papery, or you'll just see that brown hazy IPA come through. You're like, oh, I'm so sorry.
This was probably good.
Yeah.
That's two knocks against it, or actually three. If you really mm-hmm. I wonder how commercial competitions would differ, or how they would change if they were treated like homebrew competitions, where you had a first round and then you had the choice to rebrew it or whatever, you know what I mean? Because commercial competitions are here's the beer and it's all done. And that's it. It's basically one. There's different rounds within the thing, but it's you ship one set of beer, and if you make it, you make it. Right. If you don't, you don't.
So I think, GABF takes place over the course of three weekends now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. There's three phases. So the first two phases are, it's 6 days, so 3 days each, and then there is one phase right before the festival. So that's the way the layout was this year. So it's crazy because I think I don't know if many brewers realize how exhausting judging can be, and when you're doing it that way, I mean, you're like, each phase one and phase two were 3 days sessions, and or 3 days per. And then you look at your list and you have six flights, three in the morning, three in the afternoon.
Yep. We really, we work so hard, I don't think that the people out there know really go through in this. They think we're just out there they just go drink beer together and talk shit about it and have fun. And it's jovial and fun. And, no, it's mind-bendingly difficult.
It is exhausting because I did 3 days of phase one last year, not this year. And it was a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it. I met some great people. I hope I get to do it again sometime. But man, on the second day, I was so exhausted. I got on the little shuttle back to the hotel. I had a little bit of food It was like 6:30 or 7 o'clock. I went to bed. I was like, I can't, do I want to do anything? And like, no, I'm exhausted. I'm going to bed. I slept for like 11 hours and got up and did it the next day. Cause I was just that wiped out after, I mean, you're not drunk. And that's the thing. You don't drink enough. You drink a lot of beer, but it's spread out a little bit at a time. Six flights, you know, 3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon. By the time that day is over, your body is just exhausted.
You're just tired.
I'm old. Some people were like, we're gonna go to the, you know, Brew Works down in Denver. And like, God, I can't do that, guys. You have a good time. No way.
It's funny. Like,
I'm not gonna make it.
Walking around GABF, you know, like Friday night, Saturday night, you can tell, well, not Saturday night, I guess, but like Friday night, Thursday night, you can tell the people who have been judging because they're fucking zombies. They're just like done. And like, you know, Jamil, you know, he would be doing a lot of judging, and Jamil always wears his, like, I don't know, his energy level on his face. He's one of those people. And you can tell when that man is tired because he just looks fucked. Like, he just, it's the only way to describe it. And it's like, oh, you were judging. Yeah. But you know what? He pushes through and he was out, you know, drinking, at least having a beer, because he's a very social guy. But it's like that kind of thing. And judging is difficult and it is weird. The only time I ever judged the Sam Adams long shot one year is like right after I got my, you know, certificate or whatever, my recognition. I was recognized, whatever. I got invited to do that thing.
I see you.
And, you know, you show up and it was in Oakland. I'm like, okay, cool. And we go, we get the 12 rounds of whatever the fuck long shot. I was like, okay, cool. And I think it was at that point it was mixed. So there was no like specific category. Can't remember. And I'm like, oh, man. And then we broke for lunch. And I was like, all right, cool. That was awesome. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. They're like, well, yeah, that's cool. The second round will start in like an hour. I'm like,
but wait, there's
more.
What do you mean?
What do you mean the second round? I had to go. Like, I had something to do. I was like, I can't stay. I was fucking tired. 12 beers. I was done.
Yep.
Felt like an asshole. I was never invited back.
So physically and mentally taxing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I've never judged a commercial competition of that scale. I've judged commercial comps before, but not GABF or any of the other really big ones. But the year that we did NHC homebrew competition, both rounds all in one over the course of 3 days of judging. And it was brutal. Like, there were morning and middle day and afternoon, you know, almost evening. It was like all day and then all day the next day and then all day the third day.
Yeah.
And I was like, and at some point I just wanted to give up and leave the room. And I'm like, I feel like I'm doing a disservice to these entrants because my palate is completely blown. But it's like you say, there is some luck of the draw of, you know, what comes earlier and is good versus what comes later and is really good. I can't tell if this is really good anymore. Mm-hmm. I get done with all of that. And I'm like, oh, good. I can finally go to a talk. So I went to a talk my buddy's friend was doing, and I'm in there and my cell phone buzzes. Then it's Bruce Berger. And he's like, oh, I meant to ask you earlier, but do you want to do the best of show? I've never judged NHC best of show before. So I'm like, it was an honor.
Well, you have to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a, you know, a 30-minute break and I'll be right there. So, you know, wandered back over and there was a little bit of time in between and we reset and did the 34 beers or whatever it was, but it was just like, wow, that I felt like I went through a marathon. And I don't, you know, yeah, it's hard. It still was fun, but it is a challenge. And you want to, you know, a well-organized competition is not going to do a disservice to the entrant, where you keep those flights smaller, have breaks built in. And like Brian was saying, you drink a lot of beer, but it's spread over a long time and it's small samples. So,
well, I think that's why we always hammer home the point of become a beer judge. Like, there's always a need for beer judges. So things like this don't happen, because that is the worst part, you know. And like when I was doing the more beer comp, the homebrew comp, I was trying to get more judges than we need, because number one, I didn't want to be there for too long, but also like, because I knew how it felt. Like, I don't want to sit and force 15, 16 beers down people's throats. You know what I mean? I want, if you have six in a flight, that's my goal. Because it is hard. It is taxing. And I mean, even doing this show, by the like the fourth beer, you're like, oh man, what am I really tasting? I have no idea. And luckily I'm not like doing a score sheet, which is why I think the Bryans do sheets beforehand.
Yeah.
Get it out of the way. So, you know, yeah, whatever.
We can kind of talk a little more about it, have a little fun.
Yeah.
And we're not just trying to do all the work of perception while we're on air, which that's not great radio either, right? It's not great podcasting. Right, no. If we're kind of sitting there thinking and going, and writing stuff down, that's people are going to tune that out right away.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and Barry, what you were saying about it being more, not more, but just as much or just as important as a packaging competition as a beer competition, is that the number one takeaway that you can kind of give people, like commercial or homebrew? Like you can have an okay beer, but your packaging has to be on par because that could potentially push an okay beer, you know, through.
Yep. It'll definitely boot you off in the first, if not second round, depending on the category. But it's kind of amazing at how nitpicky you can actually get when you have a fight of very good beers that, you know, like if you're having individual beers, you're like, okay, this is a good beer, this is a good beer, this is a good beer. But then once you have, you narrow it down to like eight beers that make it to second or third round of a competition, they're all good beers. And then like at that point, you're nitpicking details and, you know, you're getting at bitterness, you're getting at the fine points of the bitterness, like, is it a smooth bitterness? Is it a harsh bitterness? Like you definitely start comparing astringencies. You start, and I think that's where a lot of our comments will come from, is esters. Like you'll whether they're appropriate or not, like they start popping once you get to those later rounds, and that can make or break your beer. But then, it also depends on the flight of judges that you know, not just the beers, but the flight of judges that you have, and what are they going to focus on? If there's a judge who wants to bring out something, and then everybody starts focusing on that one specific character of a beer or in the entire flight. Like I'd probably get annoyingly, like tonight I'd be talking about esters and what are you getting? What are you getting? What are you getting?
Red apple skin. Yeah, exactly.
They start that. There you get, but somebody might be super obsessed about mouthfeel or like astringency and like what's husky and what's astringent and what's grainy. And, you know, so a lot of it can depend on how the conversation gets steered in a flight too, but it's kind of amazing. Once you like eliminate those beers that, you know, poorly packaged, like oxidation, I've learned to get pretty good at where you can just like, no, it's sweet and it's muddy, oxidized, and that's an easy kick out. Yep. Or just say like it doesn't advance to the next round, but you know, it's like I know that there's a good beer under there, and like, so like that always makes it on my comments. Like if it's worthy, like it sounds like it seems like a poorly packaged beer. Like the quality, the beer itself tastes pretty good. But there's just once you just have this, like once you get a set silo, or not silo, but like a very focused, filtered set of beers, like everything starts popping. And there's definitely a good bit of luck, but that's when you're hard referencing those style guidelines too. You're like, does this fit the guidelines? Does this fit this? And then also what we talked about earlier is, will it make it onto the next, like, how will it do in the next round? So everybody might have a favorite beer, but is like, if the beer's out of style, like, will it get booted out in the next round too?
Like, yeah.
So sometimes you get like the competition.
A beer that really wows you and it's really interesting. It's like, oh, wow. It's like got this wonderful tropical, but also diesel-y, you know, hop character to it. And then the other judge is like, I just can't stand diesel. I hate it. And I'm just like, and everybody perceives things differently. So you got to think, okay, what's going to, is my like love for this beer that, you know, comes across as tropical with a little diesel going to, you know, when it gets to the next round, it tastes like a can of diesel fuel to the next round of judges. Is it going to really go on? I have to let it go. Yeah. Or whatever.
This is the beer that Mad Max drink.
Right. You're talking about packaging. It's like, I don't golf, but my dad loves to, my dad's a golfer. He's golfed for 40, 50 years. He's 80 plus years old. He still goes once a week. And he always would say a thing that stuck with me, which is, you drive for show and you putt for dough, which is the driving is the drive is the showy part. It's the fun part. Like, ooh, I hit this ball super far and I got it close. But what makes you win tournaments and games and stuff is getting that last bit from your drive into the hole.
Yeah.
And it's not the most fun part. It's probably the least fun part is putting, because that's the part that's easy to fuck up and it's easy to not get in the hole and to mess up. But it's kind of like packaging. It's not the most fun part. You know, the showy part is making a beer that tastes great. Mm-hmm. The part that's not showy, but the part that gets you to win, whether it's a beer competition or a golf game or whatever, is that last bit that isn't fun, that's hard to do, but it gets you there.
Well, but also the finesse of like taking a something like a Munich Helles, you know, and dialing it in, getting the finesse right.
Exactly.
Really, really excellent Munich Helles versus just a very good, excellent Munich Helles. Like, how do you take it to world class? And how do you keep it fresh in the packaging so it presents well there at the judges' table? Yeah.
And that's like world class is you have to do every aspect of it right, right? To win something huge like GABF and to be world class, you got to have great recipes. You got to have great brewing process. You have to have great packaging process. All of that has to fire on all cylinders. And there's not really, in my mind, there's not really a magic bullet. You have to do at least good on all those things. And the better you can do on all those things, the more likely you're going to be to win. That's just, you got to execute as best as you can on everything.
I mean, think about how many beers we've had on this show that fail in packaging for one reason or another, undercarbonated.
All the time,
oxidation. But I think a lot of the time it's funny, like doing this over, I don't know what, Cooper, 10 years.
Yeah, we're finishing out our 10th year, in 2013.
Beers have gotten so much better over time. And, before I'd be like, oh, it's oxidation or it's just weird, the bottle funk or whatever. But now I think the most constant packaging error is just carbonation, which is great. I mean,
we talk about it constantly on the show.
Yeah.
All the time. I'd say at least once every two episodes, maybe if we don't do it then, we talk about carbonation constantly.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important. Let's wrap this up real quick. I want to take a break. I want to come back and while we wrap the show, I want to talk about this Italian Pilsner we're drinking from Lucky Envelope. So hang on, everyone. It's Jesus Christ. It's Dr. Homebrew. Not the session at all.
No.
You can tell because it's only an hour. So hang on, everyone. We'll be right back.
Hello, fellow BNers. This is Sully from the 21st Amendment Brewery located in San Francisco, just two blocks from Giants Park. Before Nico and I opened the 21A and before I was a professional brewer, I homebrewed on my small four-burner apartment stove in a back house in Santa Monica, California, making my extract brews before graduating to the daunting idea of all-grain brewing. Homebrew books and information was hard to come by back then. The internet hadn't been invented yet, along with other things we take for granted today, like electricity and potable water. One thing I wish I had back then when I was learning was a radio show that could teach me the ins and outs of brewing and answer questions that I had about homebrewing, a resource for making great craft beer. The 21st Amendment Brewery is excited to be a proud sponsor of Dr. Homebrew, a great show that teaches you what you need to know about making incredible beer. Good stuff. Listen up. You might learn something. I certainly did. And thanks for your support. Tasty Crack Games.
The leader in affordable, high-quality kegerators is here. Introducing Komos, the kegerator designed with serious beer drinkers in mind. It features an all-stainless steel draft tower, a major upgrade over traditional chrome-plated brass towers, and Komos keeps your new tower cold with their air-cooled tower fan, wrapping your beer lines in frigid coolness. Your beer is poured from innovative forward-sealing faucets that don't leak, so they stay cleaner for longer. Dual gas inlets on the rear of the fridge allow you to run both CO2 and nitrogen gas. Serve your beer with CO2, serve your kegged wine or even cocktails with nitrogen. The digital temperature display has the largest range available, allowing you to use the Komos Kegerator for fermentation if you need to. And now Komos Kegerators ship with duo-tight draft fittings for that click-to-connect assembly we've all dreamed of. Buy direct from KomosDraft.com and receive free shipping on your order. That's KomosDraft.com.
I'm sorry to tell you this, but we're going to have to pour you out.
Back to Dr. Homebrew.
All right, thanks for sticking around, everybody. I appreciate it. We're wrapping up here with Barry from Lucky Envelope Brewing in Seattle, Washington. And throughout this whole conversation, we've been drinking the Italian Pilsner. Barry, what's up with this beer, man? I like it a lot. It's very clean, very... I think basic is too... It's not correct, but I guess in terms of a Pilsner, maybe it's right. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a beer we've done several versions of, but our Italian Pilsner, I mean, that's kind of one of the new hot styles that have come out in the last few years, and I really love it. But the best way I've heard it described is it's effectively a German Pilsner with Italian flair, and kind of the simplified version of it is it's a dry hopped German Pilsner. Mm. But I think it's definitely I find it to be a style which requires a little bit of finesse and more restraint, especially in the dry hop. But, you know, breweries being breweries in the United States, I think they go a little heavy, which I don't think it's bad. But I think if when you start hopping at, you know, 1 to 2 pounds a barrel for an Italian Pilsner, I think it creeps into that West Coast Pilsner category versus the Italian Pilsner, which is a little more, in my opinion. And, you know, if you taste Beerificos, their Italian Pilsner, you know, it's definitely a little more delicate of a beer, but it's very simple in terms of how we approach it. And it's, you know, it's all Weihermann Eraclea malt, which is their Italian grown barley. And it's about 30 IBU, but, you know, we do a light first wort hop in there, about a pound and a half for 15 barrels. We'll do a 3 pound 60 minute edition of German Magnum, and then a whirlpool, like a 4 pound whirlpool of Hallertau, Herzbrucker, but you can use any continental hop for that. And then we do like half a pound per barrel of a dry hop. So it's, you know, it's a very, very light, but, you know, I think especially with when you use continental noble hops, they carry in a very different manner when you use it in low levels versus higher.
That is such, I mean, this beer is almost fucking water. It's almost clear. Like the color, what is that, half an SRM?
Yeah.
That is, yeah. I've genuinely never seen a beer that has this much body and this much character. It's almost 6% be this, like, yeah, I don't know, man.
It's
like
5%. Yeah. You can't read. It's too dark in your room.
It's 5.0.
5.0. Like I thought the slash in the O was like an 8. I was like, oh shit.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
It's extremely dry. It's got a nice crackery pill small character.
Yeah.
Alongside a really bright like geranium. Like like it's declared on the can, but I was getting it in spades, like that floral character. The geraniol is really coming through from those hops. And when you amp them up like that and do it right in the whirlpool, they can play that way. I got a touch of sulfur in the nose, but it blew off really quick. And, but yeah, and once it gets into the flavors, it's that dry. It's a really drinkable summer beer that you just easily, you know, sip a lot of on a hot day. But, you know,
even now, I mean, it's like 54 degrees outside. It's raining here. And, this is perfect. It's great. I got a cat on my lap and a bladder full of urine. Like this is a perfect night.
And it's really well lagered.
What could be better?
Despite yeah, being much, fairly man. Heavily hopped, there's still not a lot to hide behind here. If there was a big flaw in it, it would poke right through. So, you know, I think, you know, even though the hops are the showcase here, it's not over hopped, and the malt still does play a part. It does have that nice crockery and that the can declares a little honey like, might be again the power of suggestion, not in an oxidized way, but like a little sweetness to it that gives it a little you know, a wider range of malt flavors than you might get in some beers this light. It's a really fun beer.
Yeah, it's really this is such a wonderful pilsner in just so many ways, and I just have to agree with everything that Coop just said.
I think that it is, you know, it didn't throw up a massive head. I guess, you know, sometimes the lighter beers the head can fade a little more quickly, but I think a little more carbonation could help drive it even a little bit more, but it's great as it is. So
yeah, good job. I love it.
Thanks.
And so you were saying earlier that you're more of a lager focused brewery.
I would like to be more lager focused. Yes. That's kind of where I geek out. Where I like to go over the top in terms of processes, and that's where, you know, getting that 90% there doesn't take that much effort. It's compared to the last like 5-10% to kind of get your beer where it wants to be. And I love geeking out on that part with you know, just trying to reduce oxidation on, especially on the cold side, but you know, just paying attention to things like pH and gravities and everything, just every step of the process, documenting things every step of the way. So I love that. I love the minutia of just trying to tweak those lagers where, you know, the vast, vast majority of people won't be able to tell it on a day-to-day difference. But when you kind of look at it in big picture, you can definitely start noticing trends and kind of seeing where things go. So, you know.
Do you take more pleasure in the customers going, hey, I've sort of noticed that this, you know, this lager tastes a little more crackery or whatever, or a fellow brewer or beer judge coming in going, hey, and like detailing the nuances that sort of reinforce the things that you're doing. Does that make sense? Is that a weird question? A weird
ideally, question. Both would happen.
Well, right. Yeah. Right.
But I feel like we definitely get more of the constructive feedback or positive feedback from folks in the industry. I know customers definitely appreciate the beers, and especially the ones that come in regularly, they will pick out things here and there and make some small changes, and I think that's super cool.
Yeah.
I guess it's
harder on the as a customer, because you don't want to sound like a fucking know-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I would have a hard time going into a place where I would, you know, would be a regular at and going like, oh, I noticed that the fucking difference of the thing or whatever. And then probably when industry people come in, there's more of a, I don't know, unspoken thing of like, hey, I need to comment on this. So yeah. Maybe it's a little skewed. Yeah.
Yeah. And it also depends on the relationship that you have. Like, you know, if the customer happens to be a beer enthusiast too, I make sure to like let them know kind of like what I did to you is like, just tear this beer apart. Like, I want to make it better. I need like, what kind of feedback do you have? And I do that with people, you know, brewers and judges that come through and all that stuff. And, you know, we get people that visit from around the country just based on where we are in our neighborhood, but also like October, like September, October is just a wonderful time to meet people from around the country, because they're flying into Seattle for hop selection, and then they're just gonna go.
Oh damn!
They will spend
nice.
Like an afternoon in the Ballard neighborhood and visit like all these breweries, and like you see them, like it's like a group of three people with the same brewery shirt on. You're like, hey, hop selection here. Do you want to chat? Like, if they have time, if they're not here, like just to cap to get a beer before they head to the airport. But yeah. You know, you can always find those people, and you meet That's a lot funny. Of. Awesome folks that way. So
yeah,
we're anyone super with, lucky.
Anyone so, with cargo shorts and sandals. That's yep, basically shorts, gonna sandals be a brewery.
And either a sweatshirt or a work shirt, you know, with the brewery name on. You're like, hey,
come on in, taste this.
I mean, you know, September, October, you should brew a beer, a light lager, and just call it I'm here for hop selection.
I'm here for the hops. Man. Yep.
Barry, thanks for taking the time, man. I appreciate it. Thanks absolutely. For sending the beer. You know, we still have a Hellas to drink, and but we'll just drink that for funsies. This Italian Pilsner is great. I like the Swiss Army beer, despite your brewing collaborators.
Yeah,
best efforts to tank it. I think you pulled it out, and I think I can really tell
thank
that.
You. Yeah. No, I really appreciate the time, and Brian and Jason, thank you for just, you know, arranging it all and trying the beers in advance, and for the very constructive and constructive feedback.
Oh,
next time thanks for your time, and thanks for the beer.
Yeah.
Taste some of the lagers there at the brewery with you if we get the chance.
Yeah.
It would be a lot of fun. So
please reach
That'll
out.
Be great.
If you're around, please reach out. And I'd be happy to show you around, and can give you recommendations and other stuff in Seattle.
Cool. No, don't do that. Yeah. Just the same. Just lucky envelope. That's it. Barry has a tent in the back. You can sleep in. This is Airbnb. He rents out $200 a night. It's great.
Yep. And then just eat at McDonald's. It's fine.
Yeah, that's right. If you want to be on the show and be as cool as Barry is currently, go to brian@thebrewingnetwork.com and whatever email device you choose to use, and he will get you set up. We have openings for whatever fermented products you have. Also, you know, last show I branched into cocktails. Why not? If you want to send us a canned cocktail, if you're working on canned cocktails, which is a new thing, sort of, I don't know.
Or send us a lager.
Sake. I like sake. Send some sake.
Dude, I had this. Just real quick. I had this liquor the other day. I got it for Christmas, actually, for my brother-in-law. I don't know the name of it, but Char, you just reminded me. Japanese Bermuto is the label. It's very blown out. It is a vermouth, essentially, but made with sake. You can't see it, but made with sake instead of wine.
That's really interesting.
And
that makes sense, because vermouth is kind of like a spiced wine.
Right.
And if you took sake and you put in like some Japanese spices or something, that could be like really cool.
It's then it's spiced with like yuzu. There you go. Bermuto.
That sounds really
acidified
cool.
Acidified with local citrus, bitters, and spices from indigenous herbs. So check that out. I don't know what made me think of that, but
I'll have to check it out. I'll be there in February.
Yeah,
cool.
Are you going to Japan in February?
Yeah.
Dude.
Oh, super cool.
Nice.
Where are you going?
We'll be in Tokyo.
Nice.
Yeah, 10 days, but all in Tokyo just to wander around.
All in Tokyo.
That'll be awesome.
I feel like it's not even enough.
No, it's not.
You know?
No.
God,
it's one of the biggest cities in the world, and there's a billion things to do. I mean, you could probably be in Tokyo for a year and not see all there you'd want to see.
No. Are you, do you have breweries planned out? Any standouts you're going to?
No. This is a family trip. So I'm going to go meet with Jason at Devilcraft because he does some of our distribution out there and all that. But Devilcraft, they make really good beer. And, we were there in 2022 I was there for a work trip without the family, but there's a couple breweries that we'll probably hit up, but I think it's mostly going to be eating and just getting whatever beer you get at the ramen place. And
forget about it.
I got to check out that Bermudo stuff.
I'll send you the picture of it. First of all, the label's wild. It's just cool. It's such a good, and you can like drink it on your own. Like vermouth, I don't really feel like you can just sip.
Yeah.
It's some people like it's not a thing I like to do.
No. Well, they're Italians. They're a little. It's like
unlike the Greeks.
Well, yeah, the Greeks are perfect. Are you kidding me? Have you seen our statues? It's almost like a more intense, more rounded bodied, like a citrus vodka kind of thing. I don't know. I'm doing it a disservice, but I could see it like in an old fashioned. You can drink it straight. Anyway, whatever. We're going to get out, everybody. Thanks a lot for tuning in. I appreciate it. See, you guys just get a podcast and you can just ramble on to your friends about nothing. Yeah. That's great.
Exactly. If you trust the bottom of this can, Luigi is the cooler brother. That's kind of.
Oh, shit.
Great little quote there. We're just playing
I loved
Super Mario Brothers Wonder today with my kid. We're having some fun on that.
Brewer started.
I play as Luigi, by the way. So
farting it around. Oh, you got to, man. You got to.
My daughter got a Switch for Christmas, so I got her one. And she's got Mario Kart, so she's got to finish getting that set up and got to get her all Mario'd up there.
Do the Shine Thief battle. It's the funnest, man.
I learned a couple months ago that people go, oh, it's a me, Mario. Apparently, like he's not saying it's me, Mario. He's saying Itsumi, I guess, which is Japanese for super. So he's been saying Super Mario the whole time, but we hear it as it's a me, Mario.
That's how I would always hear that.
Yeah, but apparently it's like Itsumi. I don't know. There you go.
The more you know.
All right, everybody. We're out of here. Thanks a lot for tuning in. We'll see you.
Cheers.
Bye.